Welcome to the Ortho Joke Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Well, good morning, Mark. How are you this morning?
I am good. I am up at the lake with all of our kids and grandkids and got the coffee cup from our local golf course.
Oh, love that.
There you go.
Very nice. So, I have one from our recent editorial board meeting in Texas. Now, I'll tell you, it was a good meeting. It was a good Dallas treated us well. So, like that, well,
that's
a souvenir.
Yeah, a big cup because everything in Texas is big, right?
Absolutely true. So today, Mark, we're going to be doing just a slight deviation. You know, you and I, you normally talk about an issue and then we'll bring in experts to speak to the issue. And I think today our hope was that we'd speak to an expert and just learn about the individual. And this particular individual is part of a new organizational structure that I know you have definitely been, you know, helping us think through, which is an executive council within the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery, an executive editor role. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce a colleague and friend, Nico Piuzzi, who is the vice chair of research, recently appointed, relatively recent, at the Cleveland Clinic. And I got to know Nico, gosh, it's been years that I've gotten to know him. And it's so funny because you interact with folks kind of often, with, you know, virtually, and then you meet them and then you end up working with them. So it's been one of those sort of trajectories for myself. And I'm really, really excited and honored to have him, with us at the journal. So welcome, Nico.
Thank you, Mo. Thank you, Mark. Pleasure to join you this morning. It's, at the end, it's a pleasure to join you both in the role of executive editor in JBJS, but also as somebody who is passionate about what we do, just as what you've shown the way for many years. So pleasure to be here this morning. I do have my cap as well here in Cleveland. Yeah. on the last day in the office before the holidays. So it's
I am actually surprised, Nico, that cup is not branded. It's just white. I'm surprised you didn't throw a logo on that.
Well, I cannot show the logo on the other side.
Okay. Very good. Maybe, Mark, I'll jump in first. And Nico, yeah. I wonder if you could just talk to us a little bit about how you got into orthopedics. What was the impetus, or did you have any specific events that said, okay, this is my career path?
Yeah. So early on, I'll start. I think how I got to orthopedics gets explained a little bit of how I got introduced into medicine. I was in between different careers. I come from a family of engineers. I was the first physician in my family. And early on, I was deciding if I wanted to go into engineering school, if I wanted to go to medicine, or I wanted to do politics. So I ended up tailoring towards the last two, medicine and politics. And I remember a conversation with my dad, and he said, well, Nico, you can always serve people in politics if you're a physician, but if you become a politician, you'll never be able to be a physician. So went into medicine. As I navigated through med school, when I had to decide, I liked a lot of different subspecialties. Everything.
Hey Nico, where is this happening? Where in the world were you when all this was happening?
So this is in Buenos Aires. This is in Argentina. So back home, ended up deciding to do orthopedics basically because it allowed me to play in that dual arena of being able to be in the OR, but also being able to interact with patients, clinics, and have that dual side of it that I enjoyed. Once I got into orthopedics, serendipity, how I ended up in hip and knee, I liked large, big surgeries. At that point, I was looking when I was, I ended up training at the Italian Hospital of Buenos Aires, one of the leading institutions worldwide with a long tradition of orthopedics. And when I was finishing, I wanted to do something different. I knew that I had trained at the top of the mark on what has been the techniques that we had today, but I wanted to see if I could help shape or do my grain of salt on the future. So that's back in 2016. I ended up coming to the Cleveland Clinic for a combined fellowship for joints and orthobiologics. I did a two-year program, spending time in the lab, doing innovation and cell therapy treatments, bone grafting. And long story short, after those 2 years, I got an offer to stay and join the staff at the Cleveland Clinic. And it's been a fun ride since then.
Wow, that's fantastic. So the combination of innovation and biologics and arthroplasty, can you tell us a little bit more about how those two interface?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something that is changing, it's evolving as we go. If we look at how the journey has happened in arthroplasty, it has been heavily dependent upon innovation in material science, implant design, more recently, technology, robotics, and tools. When I think of what the future might hold, is I think it's the combination of biology with the tradition of metals and implant design. And when I say that, is that all the implants nowadays, they basically rely on the host being able to heal into them. Moving into the future, we hopefully will be able to combine different regenerative engineering principles so that we are not only having osteoconduction, but we're having osteoinduction and be able to combine different strategies so that we can maximize osteointegration, survivorship, and be able to play a little bit more with the interaction with biology, trying to incentivize it in those scenarios where there might be some host-related or more challenging environments, both on the primary and revision setting. And that applies for arthroplasty across different joints, but also in different subspecialties as we move through trauma or chronic conditions.
Where do you think, Nico, the future is going broadly, you know, in your subspecialty area? Do you see the world being very different in the next 5 years or pretty similar with just incremental advances?
It's hard to tell because when I look back at how I trained in 2016, before 2016, both in residency at the Italian Hospital or here at the Cleveland Clinic, like in two different settings in different parts of the continent, we were doing robotic surgery very, very rarely. We did early on navigation with the tumor team in Argentina that they navigated bone resections and they navigated bone autografts. When I came here to the US, we had just the first deployment of the first robotic platform. And fast forward to today, we're doing extremely high percentages of robotic surgery, and I would have not been able to predict the rapid adoption. I do foresee that there is great potential in the next 5 years. I do think that how we're processing data and how we're integrating into clinical workflows will potentially morph quickly and might reshape how we're practicing. I think that the changes and the innovation on the implant and material, I don't foresee any major changes in that time frame, but 5 to 10, I think there's some very interesting early phase projects that might reshape how we do things.
And do you think, I mean, so you have a unique perspective, right? I mean, you know, you grew up in Argentina, you know, you're now working at a leading institution in the US, you're doing very innovative things, and you're going to continue to push the envelope. Do you think that the gap in orthopedic care around the world is increasing? In other words, technology is, you know, developed nations just pushing us further away. And then the catch up, being able to disseminate some of these technologies is going to get harder and harder. Or are we going to be able to see more of a leveling because maybe technology is going to level the field very quickly?
So I think we're living very interesting times. The life expectancy has changed drastically globally in the past several decades, right? Transmittable disease have been much better controlled in Africa and worldwide, and the life expectancy is growing. So at the end, globally, we're facing this challenge of chronic conditions. And the field is living this environment where we are faced with more and more musculoskeletal disease and a burden of disease that is increasing. How we tackle that in a profession that requires instrumentation, implants, and devices to be able to deliver that care, it's a continuous challenge. And I do agree that technology gets applied in a dissimilar manner and access to it becomes challenging in many scenarios, even in developed countries where access to it is not uniformly distributed in countries like in the United States. Nonetheless, I do have to say that if we look back at technology and how it's been applied and the Moore law, at the end, the cost of technology comes down over time. When cell phones came at the beginning, they were a luxury accessory. Nowadays, everybody in every socioeconomical level holds a cell phone. So the type of technology and the access that we might have, I think first needs to determine the value that it's providing to the care that we're delivering. And second, with cost that will probably come down over the years, might make it scalable and might help provide that care in a broader spectrum. And more importantly, in a cost-effective manner, and with safety, and that quality that could be hopefully ensured across every setting and every geography globally.
That's a great bit of insight there, Nico. Of course, Mo and I are trauma folks. And part of the issue globally is the fact that everybody's got a motorcycle now, with road traffic issues being a huge problem as the underdeveloped nations continue to expand their ability to go fast and crash. But that's a separate question. Can you tell us and our listening audience about what you're personally working on now, your personal research agenda?
So the main theme and vision of our program at this moment is to try to advance evidence-based orthopedics through a personalized approach. Now, how do we take that vision into reality and what we're doing on the tactical side? Actually, and we've developed already multiple predictive models, both for risk factor stratification early on before surgery, when we're trying to understand if a patient is a surgical candidate and we're trying to navigate it. And we're putting to work all those predictive modelings into different care pathways. So if your patient scores high in different risk profiles, we integrate a multidisciplinary team to guide the patient through the surgical episode. Then in the surgical episode, at the time of surgery, we're integrating different data elements to try to fit the best alignment philosophy and the best and safest environment to perform that surgery, either if it's an outpatient, inpatient, and the setting and the instrumentation or resources required, and then tailor that and link it to the aftercare of surgery and be able to put every patient in the right setting. Because it's not, we don't agree with the principle of saying everybody should go home or everybody should go to SNF. It's the patient that needs a skilled nursing facility, needs to go to a skilled nursing facility, and the patient that can do well with just virtual physical therapy just needs to have virtual physical therapy and push through. So how do we do a data-driven approach through that continuum of care is where we've put most of our energy and tasks and resources lately. Next to that, the other big piece that we're putting tremendous amount of energy is in two different areas. One is in osteoarthritis. We developed a center of excellence in osteoarthritis where we are integrating multi-level analytics. So we have, we're facing the largest disease that we're facing is osteoarthritis. It's the largest condition that we treat. It's the main reason why we do arthroplasty today. We don't have any disease-modifiable treatment. So in order to address that, we're looking at each patient with osteoarthritis that we treat. We take their functional data, we take imaging, we take all the clinical elements that we can extract from the electronic health record. We are including things outside of our scope and our field. So we're teaming up with pain specialists, looking at functional MRI, looking at outside of the box into how to actually interpret biological samples. So all the different tissues from around the knee, we create a biorepository where we have over 1,000 patients and we're doing proteomics, degradomics, biomarker assessment. And then once you have all those very detailed and in-depth data elements, we integrate all that and we're trying to phenotype the different buckets of osteoarthritis to try to determine the targets of treatments and then trace back to try to develop a treatment early on and be disruptive into finding disease-modifiable treatments. And the last big bucket is periprosthetic joint infection. One of the main challenges that we face in arthroplasty today and in our field in orthopedics is the treatment of infections. So in that regard, we also put a multidisciplinary team with microbiologists, with infectious disease, epidemiologists, and more importantly, with immunologists, trying to understand the immune host response and the host better, trying to figure out why infections happen and how we can treat them in a multifactorial approach.
That's a huge list of items to be working on. But I know the current editor-in-chief, and he's all about having some balance in life. So why don't you tell us what you do outside of that very long research agenda?
Yeah, and I'll jump in and say, you know, there's got to be some way that you recharge yourself. Because when you're, when you're trying to change the world like you are, Nico, you know, you've got to just take a step back once in a while, a quiet place. Maybe you do something. Maybe you ride a bike. I don't know what you're up to. But tell us how you find a way to continue to maintain all this energy.
So I'll go to that question, but I like to enjoy each moment as much as possible. I'm enjoying this moment with you, Mo, and Mark, right? And I try to choose and be very purpose in where I spend time. So it's true that I just listed a tremendous list and we left a lot of projects even outside of that list that we are doing, but it's not me. I get to work with a tremendous, tremendous team, right? And I enjoy putting teams together and working with those teams and spending time with my team. How do I recharge and how I make that happen? I have the best team of all at home. I have a beautiful wife, Delphi, and four children, age of 9, 7, 4, and 8 months.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that you're doing all this and you have that already, I have to give you a slow clap. That's impressive. That's impressive.
I won the lottery with my wife. So what I like doing is when I get home, I like spending time with the family. I go for runs when I need to clear my mind. I try to do that several times a week and enjoying the present. So I spend time with friends. Every time I have an opportunity, we travel. We try to spend time outside. And if I have to pick one thing that I really enjoy and gets me to just think of something else, is go out fishing. Any kind of fly fishing, deep sea fishing, or you name it. And my biggest problem is just not to get a tangle and just hopefully maybe get a fish or be outside. It's a fantastic day.
Well, I'm going to give you a piece of advice, life advice. The only thing better than going fly fishing alone is to take someone with you to go fly fishing. So I'm raising my hand right now. I'm always available. I'm always available.
We have it on the bucket with the Steelhead Run here in Cleveland in the fall. It's amazing. The boats that we float have two passengers, so we always have to go with somebody else.
Amazing. Amazing. I don't know, Mark, if you have any final comments or any thoughts, but that was great.
No, it's wonderful to get to chat with somebody new on the editorial leadership team and with a lot of energy and insight and clearly a data scientist as well. And it's going to be fun to watch Nico's career further develop and further advance our field. So welcome to the JBJS leadership team, Nico.
Thank you so much. And I will just end with one short comment that I think is a good analogy to one of the key reasons why I'm passionate about joining you. And Mo and you have been very purpose in the global role that the journal plays, right? And just as the world has embraced global cuisine and we all take the sushi from Japan, pasta from Italy, or tacos from Mexico, and foods from Thai, or you name it, right? Orthopedic has done the same journey, right? So we've been able to take those same principles that have been developed across different countries and being able to globalize them and share and teach them and document them. And that happened with arthroscopy, pioneered in Japan and then refined and worked in the US, happened with total hip arthroplasty with Chandler in the UK, or the AO fixation principles in Switzerland, and the list continues, right? So I hope that together we can continue to resonate and be that sounding board to take that the best of each of us and that excellence that is not restricted to geography from around the world, and just an open call to any researcher, colleague around the globe that wants to join us. Just reach out. We're always here, and I'm as passionate and committed and available to make that happen.
That's very kind of you, Nico. But next time you list food, you better start listing empanadas.
I should have.
I was going to say, it was so eloquent that I think you may be a politician too, my friend. I think you may be. It was beautiful. Nico for president, 2020, whatever. I'm voting. Anyways, thank you so much. It's been a lovely, and we look forward to continuing to work with you and sharing many, many great memories as we go forward. Thanks again, Nico.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.